I found out later that he was gay and he didn't have children and he didn't plan to, and so he didn't think that was an appropriate question. But I didn't know that. But so there were isolated instances, I guess. But by and large, I didn't think there was a whole lot. When I came to New Orleans to do my internship, I followed an intern the previous year who had been very difficult, apparently, to work with. And she had been the only female intern that year. And she was noted for going upstairs at 10 o'clock when she was on call and refusing to come down again because she had set her hair. You know, which I think is probably more an abuse on her part than on anyone else's. But people were kind of watching to see if I was going to do the same thing. But I never felt discriminated against there. I had my own on-call room. And I thought I fit in, you know, to that program. I think that when I joined the faculty at Tulane, there probably is clear discrimination in academic medicine that I think still exists. It's much more difficult for women to advance to chairmanship positions, etc., in academic medicine than it is for men. It's still largely a good old boy network, and women just can't be good old boys. You know, I mean, they can like you, they can respect you as a colleague, but you're never going to be a good old boy.
Yeah.
Just by definition.
Have you faced any of that discrimination with being in Alabama, perhaps, where, you know, women are still seen as more objects than not people themselves?
Well, my role here is different. You know, at Tulane, where I was on the faculty, and there was a degree of, competition for chief spots and things like that. It was a little more obvious. I didn't really want that. I didn't feel I had either the personality or the interests for running a department. I didn't like the paperwork, and I didn't want to have to deal with employee problems and things like that, and scheduling and that kind of thing. I really wanted to remain just one of the members. It also was, you know, I had a bunch of kids, and I didn't have the time to do anything more than what I was doing. But I just wasn't interested in it. But I think if I had been interested, it would have been harder than for a man. Here, it's a little bit different because I'm the only one, you know, and I'm not sure that where I'm different because of being female and where I'm different because of taking care of HIV patients. You know, there are two things here.
Have you ever faced discrimination for taking care of HIV patients? Been not necessarily treated with the highest regard, you know, because of who you do see?
I mean, I think there's undoubtedly a sense of discrimination there. I know that when I first came here, I saw a woman who's lived in this community for some time and had an infection on her hand. I was treating her. She, of course, was not HIV infected, and this was not an HIV-related disease in any way. But I had been seeing her for several months, and she was having some sinus problems, and I wanted her to see an ENT physician. She went back to see her ENT physician, who she had seen on numerous occasions in the past. And because I had called and made the appointment for her this time, they made her sit in a separate waiting room all by herself, and he examined her ears from across the room. And she was incensed, and she knew immediately why he was doing it, and so she came back and told me. She said, that really made me mad. She said, I don't want to pay for that visit. He couldn't see my ears from across the room. You know, so clearly there is discrimination in that kind of professional sense. It's harder because the discrimination otherwise, the personal, more personal discrimination, not wanting to consult you or things like that, or refer patients to you because you see AIDS patients, is harder to define. I mean, how do you know what they didn't send you, you know, or why they didn't send it? So those get kind of complicated. It's hard to say. Do they not send it to you because you treat AIDS patients? Do they not send it to you because you're female? Do they not send it to you because they're too dumb to know they ought to? You know, those are hard, so I don't really know. I think that probably the closest I could come on that is that the when we were having all the trouble initially when we opened the clinic and there was a lot of publicity, you know, some pro, some con, that the women I met professionally, the nurses, the female physicians, office workers, were all extremely supportive, very positive, offered to help, and in general, the male physicians were very unreceptive. And made a lot of negative comments. And I think that's probably more because of their fear of HIV infection than because I'm a female physician.
Mm. Discuss the controversy of the clinic being in the town of Oxford, because there was a problem with the fact that it was just like less than a half a block down the street from the city council, and there was always a misconception that the clinic was ran out of Oxford when, in fact, it chose to leave on its own because it had outgrown its building. How was the clinic received in the beginning? Because I know the mayor of Oxford was not too thrilled with its being there.
That's true. When I came here and wanted to continue to see HIV-positive patients, I initially tried to see them in my office at Anniston Medical Clinic, but that was unsatisfactory because I really didn't have the right setup there. You need more than just an office, I think, to see HIV patients. You need social services and things that you just don't have in most physicians' offices. And so that was why I originally wanted to open the clinic, and at that time ASK was housed in what had been a chiropractor's office. So there was the building was not inappropriate for a doctor's office. And we were able to adapt it to be reasonably functional. I had some, you know, reluctance in the past, and sometimes in hospitals and all, to have HIV patients housed in certain areas, et cetera. And so, but I had been able to overcome that, I think, reasonably easily with just a little educational effort. And I really didn't conceive that there would be any greater problem than that in Oxford. Before we opened the clinic, the mayor asked us to meet with the fire department, the police department, the EMT services, and himself. And so we did, and I gave them a little AIDS 101 seminar and talked to them about how it's transmitted and how it's not transmitted. And at the end of that, the mayor was very rude and, in fact, rather threatening. He said that he couldn't stop us from opening the clinic there, but he didn't want it there. And he subsequently told the firemen that if there should be a fire in the building, that they were just to go on down to Hardee's and have a hamburger and let it burn, and that kind of thing. We got a lot of publicity as a result of his attitude, which I think was ultimately very helpful to us. And we did open the clinic. I think we were harassed to some degree. You know, policemen driving by and taking down all the license plate numbers for the cars parked in front of the clinic so they'd know who was HIV positive and who wasn't. That kind of thing. And that went on for some time. And some of the neighbors were, you know, kept saying that it would destroy their property values, etc. But the clinic was fairly successful. We did see the patients. We did take care of them. So that was the big thing. And then we were able to get a Ryan White grant about 9 months after we opened. And that gave us the financial support to really do what we needed. When we got the Ryan White grant, we needed more personnel. During the first year, the clinic operated strictly on a voluntary basis, and we only had one paid employee, and that was the secretary. So there was no one there all the time, and we really didn't need offices for people. When we got our Ryan White grant, and we hired a full-time social worker and a full-time nurse and a full-time executive director, we needed some place for these people to stay while they were working. And the facility in Oxford just didn't have that much room. We were offered the building where we are now in Hobson City at about that time at a pretty reasonable rent, we felt. And we thought that the move was good for us for several reasons. Certainly it didn't hurt us to be in a community that was primarily a community of color. We needed to get more into that community. We were largely an all-white organization and had difficulty in reaching the minority groups, where HIV infection is an even greater problem than in the whites. And so we were anxious for a number of reasons to make the move. This facility is much larger, of course, and we do have office space and space where we can do a few programs and things like that. So that was the reason why we moved. We were certainly not in any sense run out of Oxford. By the time we moved, all the problems that we had pretty much dissipated.
Do you feel that a part of the stigma could have been because a lot of this area, or maybe not a lot, but several of the volunteers that were there were homosexual, or the stigma attached to the disease being gay-related?
Well, I think that homophobia is extremely strong in this area, and that AIDS continues to be a gay disease in most people's minds in this area, even though we know that the statistics are that it's not anymore, and even though we're not seeing the numbers of gay males that we were in the past, it's still perceived as being a gay disease. And I think that that's a lot of the reason for the hostility. Now, I think that the founder of ASK was certainly not reluctant to admit his homosexuality, and that offended a lot of people and may have made things worse. But I think the main thing was the fear of the disease, the fear of homosexuality and in general, rather than any personal thing.
Could you estimate about how many patients you've probably seen since the onset of this disease that you've seen personally?
Well, we've seen about 300 here. And, I had 350 in my clinic in New Orleans when I left at the VA, and probably had seen a couple of hundred at Tulane and probably that many at Charity. So it's probably been close to 1,000, I would guess.
Yeah. Because I remember at the symposium last year in the panel discussion, the question was how many patients would you estimate you've seen, and the other two male physicians around there were, you know, maybe 20, maybe 30, and you were well over that mark.